about this institute. This is also one of the reasons. So yes, today I'd like to talk about how very light, ultralight fields, bosonic fields, interact with massive black holes. And well, the thing I think is interesting because, well, we are used to how black holes interact with standard matter. So I'll try to give you some motivation to study instead the interaction between black holes and, say, fundamental matter fields. So this picture actually should represent what a black hole with some matter around it is would look like. Of course, this is not a black hole. And if you look at it from a different perspective, actually it's a drill. And this is just to advertise the work of this artist. This project is called Black Hole, indeed. And I mean, there are a lot of fancy pictures in this website. So OK, what is my presentation about? So well, there are two fighters here. One, what I call Goliath. Of course, there is nothing biblical here. So I will focus on massive black holes. So by massive, I mean by astrophysical standards, so between 10 and billions of solar masses. And on the other side of the ring, there is a light field. And by light, I mean something between 10 to minus 20, 10 to minus 9 electron volts, so very light by say, standard model standards. And the reason why I'm considering this kind of particle is because, well, when you compare the Compton wavelength of these very light bosonic fields with the size of an astrophysical black hole, what you get is that the two sides are comparable. So this is basically comparable to the black hole horizon. And so you may expect that this particle interacts quite strongly gravitationally with astrophysical black holes. And indeed, the system is quite clean because this is the only kind of interaction. So the equivalence principle and the Noether theorem guarantee that these objects are all interacting really gravitationally in a very simple way. So this is very simple to study. And the idea that I would like to put forward today is that black holes, astrophysical black holes, and current observations may already be used as a kind of particle physics laboratory to where we can, say, put particle physics to the test and also doing interesting tests of modified gravities. So here is an incomplete list of what I'm going to discuss today and what I've been studying in the last few years. There are kind of interesting effects, strong field effect that occurs close to black holes. And well, the twist that I'll try to give you today is always having in mind some astrophysical consequences, in the sense that eventually we would like to, say, extract some constraint on extension of the standard model, dark matter candidates, etc.
So the mass of the field, is the mass of a particle of the light field, or is that the total mass then 100 Schwarzschild radii, or what is the 10 to the minus 20?
Well, essentially, is would be the, say, the bare mass in the action of the field. So the, say, if you have a scalar field, the coefficient of the.
Do you have an estimate for the total mass of the field, of the energy density near the black hole? I mean, just to compare it to that other number, 10 to the 8.
Right. Actually, I think I don't.
But it's still much, much less than.
It's still much. Yeah, I mean, it is surely, I mean, within the perturbation that basically you consider this as a perturbation of a fixed background. So, I mean, it doesn't, to first order, it doesn't modify the background. Okay, so yeah, right about that. So, what I'm going to discuss next is directly or indirectly related to this phenomenon that I guess that everybody here knows. So, it's black hole superradiance. So essentially, precisely at linear level, you may think about a wave propagating on a fixed background given by a Kerr black hole, spinning black hole. And if the frequency of the wave is smaller than some number, given by the angular velocity at the event horizon, this number here, well, then the wave is amplified. So essentially, the wave scattered of the black hole has an energy which is larger than what you throw in initially. And the difference in energy comes at the expense of the black hole angular momentum, which decreases. So basically, the black hole is spinning down. And the interesting, one of the interesting reasons why superradiance is important, I think, is that even though this is you can study it at linear level, you somehow have an intuition that what is going on at nonlinear level, because the black hole is spinning down, so essentially you are extracting energy from the black hole. Another interesting point is that superradiance requires dissipation. So it basically is a classical phenomenon which occurs in many other situations. But for a black hole, dissipation is very simple. It's just the black hole horizon that behaves like a one-way membrane. So basically, everything is very well under control, and we can study it very simply. So why black hole superradiance is important? Well, in the first part of my talk, I will discuss how superradiance has something to say about the interaction between black holes and light massive fields. Well, this picture is taken from a series of papers by Arvanitaki and collaborators, and they were discussing the so-called Axiver scenarios. So in these scenarios, there are a series of particles which populates all the mass spectrum down to the Planck mass. So this is the mass of the particle. It's always very small. Well, this particle actually comes from moduli compactification in some string theory scenarios. And also, they are motivated, for example, they were proposed to solve the strong CP problem in this region here of masses. So today, I'm going to focus on this range of parameter, because there are different kind of interesting phenomenological effects. Let me see. So are you talking about?
So on the top, it's got the gray anthropically
constrained. Right. Well, actually, I don't know exactly what, which kind of constraint you can have there. Yeah. Sorry, can you say it?
It's just that the actions in that mass need to be fine tuned in order to not overclose the
universe. I see.
And it's just a coincidence that those masses are also the same as the black hole.
It's thermal production? So they just need to be thermal?
No misalignment production.
Okay, no problem. Why these kind of particle in that mass range are interesting is because of the so-called black hole bomb mechanism. So what happens is that if you have a spinning black hole and you enclose it by a mirror, then even a single, say, photon produced near the horizon within the superradiant condition is amplified, as is shown in this picture. Then it goes to, say, to infinity, is reflected at the mirror. It goes back, is amplified again by superradiance, and this process continues, and basically is extracting energy from the black hole. The black hole spins down. And of course, at some point, the system becomes unstable because the radiation pressure grows without any bound. And at linear level, what you see is the appearance of an exponentially growing mode. So this is the signature of the instability. And of course, putting a mirror around black hole is quite artificial. But there are situations in which, fortunately, this may happen in realistic scenarios. Well, one is in the case of ADS boundaries. So if you have an ADS boundary, the time-like boundary at infinity for certain boundary condition behaves like a perfect mirror. And this is actually why the reason why small Kerr ADS black holes are unstable, because of this mechanism. And the other mechanism that I'm going to discuss today is the presence of massive field. So you may imagine that when you have a massive field, the potential well is something like that. So at infinity, instead of going to zero, it goes to a constant. And then for any frequency which is smaller than the mass of the scalar field, basically this behaves like a mirror. So the frequency is reflected instead of propagating to infinity. And actually, this is the reason why scalar fields with very small masses are unstable around the Kerr black holes. And indeed, the simplest way to show the instability is just taking the Klein-Gordon equation, and this is the mass term here, and you solve it on a Kerr background. Well, what you get is indeed an unstable mode, and the instability is stronger when this mass term here times m, this is a dimensional quantity, is order 1, which translates in the fact that the Compton wavelength is the same as the black hole. And the stability time scale is quite long compared to the mass of the background, is around 10 to 6, which also means that if you want to perform a numerical simulation, you have to evolve your simulation quite a lot. But compared to astrophysical standard, it's extremely small. So if the mass of the black hole is of the order of the solar masses, this number is of the order of the seconds. So extremely smaller than what you get, for example, for a typical accretion time scale. I mean, the mass range of astrophysical black holes, what you get is that black hole superradiance is astrophysically relevant in the sense that the time scale is shorter than the accretion time scale, precisely in the range that I told you before. So when the mass of the particle is between 10 to minus 10, 10 to minus 22 electron volt. So we understand this instability very well. There have been a lot of studies, numerical simulation, analytical approximation, etc. And I'm just going to show you the final picture. Well, what we think actually is the final state of this kind of instability. So what you get is that at some point you are extracting energy from the black hole because of this instability. But since the superadiant condition is a threshold condition, at some point you get a metastable situation in which you have, say, an axionic cloud around the spinning black hole. But the important point is that the black hole has a maximum a maximum spin, which is smaller than the Kerr bound. And then this system may emit gravitational waves in various ways, for example, by atomic-like, say, transitions, because this behaves very similar to a gravitational atom. So there are axion states with different energies, and you may basically going from one energy to the other emitting gravitational waves. But this is actually only partially interesting because these waves are high-frequency waves on the order of the kilohertz. And those are actually very difficult to detect with, say, ground-based detector or even space-based detector. And actually, this was one of the reasons why Arvanitaki and Geraci last year proposed different kind of gravitational wave detector using optically trapped resonances, basically to be able to tune the sensitivity of the detector to get, to be able to detect these kind of signals. But what I think is more interesting, since we still have to wait for gravitational wave a bit, is this kind of bounds that you may put already with current observations. And the reasoning is the following. So if you suppose that this superadiant instability is really effective for spinning for astrophysical black hole, then we shouldn't see any spinning black hole with high spin in the universe. But since we do, and there are actually measurements, which are these red points here, well, we can reverse the argument and say, OK, but then if these objects are really spinning black holes there with that mass and that value of the angular momentum, we can use those data to rule out some parameter space of these axiverse scenarios.
This was still using the linear approximation? Not doing a study that looks at possible situations.
Right. So these are actually, yes, these numbers here are within the linear approximation. There have been some studies in the nonlinear approximation. I'm going to comment on them in a few slides.
You have a situation where you're extracting angular momentum from one process, but you're increasing the spin by accretion.
So exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So
how would you say?
Yeah. So this is precise. This is precisely this. So this is called Rege plane. Is the angular momentum of the black hole versus the mass of the central object. And so, for example, focus on this blue line here. This is for a mass of 10 to minus 18 electron volt. And this threshold line is when the time scale of the instability is shorter than the accretion time scale. And here they are considering accretion at the Eddington rate. So this is the Zapater time, 10 to 7 years. So essentially what happens is that above this line here for this kind of mass, you shouldn't observe any black hole, because if there was a black hole there in a time scale of the order of the second, it would go down here, losing angular momentum because of the superadiance. And then it will stop somewhere here when the time scale is shorter, is larger than the accretion. But since we observe such kind of object here, and there are objects also at larger and lower masses, well, then we can basically say there couldn't be no particle at this with that mass. So essentially, combining data sets, this is for supermassive black holes, but we have also measurements for, say, tensor massive black holes, you can rule out a window of different masses of this kind of particles.
How fast do those curves go up? Like, suppose it's 10 to the minus 12 electron volts. How would that?
Right, so let me think. So there should be something very similar to what I'm showing here in the mass range 10 to minus 12. But then, it's not that they go up. Actually, they go in this direction here.
Oh, okay.
So essentially, you have no hope to rule out 10 to minus 12 electron volts using supermassive black holes. But
then, what's the lightest thing we could, like, I'd say 10 to the minus 18 is dead,
right,
for sure. So what's
right,
the lightest one?
10 to minus 10, more or less.
Minus 10.
Yeah. Right. For a black hole of about 10 solar masses. So the region is precisely that, 10 to minus 10 up to somewhere here. Well, of course, here we have no data, but this is probably the.
Yeah, so if you have data, you're 10 to the minus 10 or lighter, you're.
Yeah, this is completely. Yeah, this is completely not relevant for them. Yeah. I mean, they are still unstable, but the instability is so weak that it plays no role compared to the accretion.
What happened at the nonlinear level? Fields will start getting energy from the black hole. So at what point do you say, well, like, this linear study may not be good,
mm-hmm,
because it might kick itself out?
Right. So there have been some nonlinear studies. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to tell. So there are two outcomes, as you said. So one is that when the amplitude of the field is not large enough, you get precisely here the same thing. So there is a slow drainage of the angular momentum. When it's large enough, well, some different kind of effect happens. There was this work by Kodama and Yoshino, a series of work. Well, they show basically that if you wait long enough, what happens is that this axionic cloud collapses because of nonlinear effects. And then there is a kind of explosion. They call it Bose-Nova. It's similar to what happens in, well, they see similar phenomena in bosons and condensate in condensed matter. And that actually will be followed by an explosion which releases a lot of gravitational waves, or a lot of energy in gravitational waves. But yeah, actually, this picture seems to be quite so. At least in the SCAR case, of course, it depends a bit on the linear nonlinear term that you consider. They are considering the nonlinear term that comes from this QCD axiom. So it's a sign of the field, basically. This is the nonlinear interaction term. Of course, things can be different for different things.
And with these lines, is anything above the line would be not allowed?
Right.
So if there are data points inside anywhere, not just right. along the line, but anywhere
right.
inside, then it's
rolled up. Right. So essentially, you take this point here, and you may draw different lines for different masses. Anytime this point is within this line, above this line, mm-hmm. you may basically rule out the corresponding mass. So essentially, each of these points rule out only a window, which goes from here. Then there should be another mass, which is something like that, and then you may only rule out that region. Okay, so you may also think, what about vector fields? Because that was only for scalar fields. And vector fields are only interesting dark matter candidates. There is this nice review by Goodsell and collaborators. And, well, the kind of theory that people have looked at to make dark matter and other interesting phenomena are these kind of theories where you have more than one, say, Maxwell field, but they are coupled in some non-minimal way. And actually, these theories are very complicated because they have this matrix interaction. So, I mean, for each of these kind of couplings, you have different theories. But this is actually one of the beauty of black hole theory, of black hole physics, because black holes are completely blind to the way that this particle couples to, say, normal photons. And so as soon as you want to just to understand how these are called hidden photons behaves near a black hole, well, what you want to solve is just an equation as simple as this one. This is the Proc equation, where you have a Maxwell field with a mass term. This propagates 3 degrees of freedom. And even though it's extremely simple, well, basically, since last year, people didn't succeed in solving this equation on a Kerber ground. This is for some technical problem that arises precisely because of this extra mass term. But the problem is interesting because there are clues that the instability should be stronger for vector field than for scalar field. And the reason is that because super radiance is stronger for electromagnetic wave than it is for scalar waves. So, last year, actually, with two different methods, people have been able to solve that equation. One method is an approximation. So it's basically considering a slow rotation expansion of the perturbation equations. Well, the method is nice, so I'm just going to show you how it works. And this was a work that we did last year. So it works the following. At zero order, you get a set of two equations, which are completely decoupled because you are expanding everything in a basospheric harmonics. And basically, the background has the same symmetries. But then if the background is rotating, then you are basically breaking the symmetries. And if you insist in using a basospheric harmonic, what you get is mode mixing. So you couple perturbation with a different parity, so the axial perturbation with the polar perturbation, and they have also different multipolar indexes. So you are coupling all together, but the nice thing is that you can do this perturbatively order by order. And there are kind of selection rules that tells you that only particularly coupling to different multipolar indexes are coupled together. So essentially, at second order only you get perturbation with L plus 2 and L minus 2, there is this kind of selection rule. Indeed, this is just like what you are used to do in quantum mechanics, and these coefficients here are the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So, I mean, this procedure is very well known, and what you end up with is with a coupled system of ODEs, and you can solve it very, very simply at linear level. Just to for example, to understand if if there are unstable modes in the spectrum. And what you get, indeed, so these are the results of the slow rotating approximation. So, well, basically, what this plot is showing is the imaginary part of the mode. When it's positive, it means that the mode is exponentially growing. So each time, basically, there are these kind of cups here, the mode is becoming unstable. And it becomes unstable precisely at the supergradient conditions. So this is actually what happens in the scalar, in the vector field. This is what happens in the scalar field. So it happens precisely the same. The only difference is the scale of these plots here. This scale is three orders of magnitude larger than what you get in the scalar case. And basically, this is an indication that in the vector case, the instability is much, much stronger. And of course, these are just extrapolation from the slowly rotating approximation. Well, last year, Helvi Wittek in Lisbon and other people did a numerical simulation of this kind of system in the extremal case, so for a black hole very close to the Kerr bound. And what they found is an instability which is of the same order of magnitude of these extrapolations here. So these results seems very solid. And of course, since the instability is stronger, what you can do is precisely play the same game as I showed you before. You go back to the Regge plane and draw those threshold line. The only difference that you get from the previous case is that these lines are now almost extend to j equals 0 because the instability is stronger. So this means that any observation of a black hole with a non-vanishing spin will rule out some interesting region of the parameter space. So even if data, instead of being here, are somewhere here around 0.2, well, this instability should be effective anyway. Let me see. No, the instability. So the instability. Yeah. So this should be a fit of the instability. Right. But so there are two things. If the field is too heavy, then the instability goes down exponentially. So there is only a window in which is effective. And when the field is very small, well, the instability goes down with higher power of mu.
So it should. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is actually why you get instability only. I mean, it's always a window, so you get instability in within a certain range of the mass of the parameter.
But following the previous plot, so can we understand or read something else? So the scalar case,
uh-huh.
The imaginary part kind of passing those for larger j.
Yeah.
Value, well, this one's keep growing.
So you shouldn't trust this number in this region here because it's the is a slower approximation. In fact, these numbers turns out to be in very good agreement with the full result. Because in the scalar case, we can do the full result. Basically, this is just a sanity check that the method worked well. It more or less, it does asymptotes, but then when it goes very close to j equal 1, it goes down again. This is just to tell you that, well, there are different experiments nowadays trying to put constraints on these light photons, and these are different regions of the parameter space. The nice thing is that to this picture, now we can add a new element here given by black hole superagents. Of course, as we were discussing, we can only say something. We have only something to say for very low masses, so there is nothing to say in this regime here. But on the other hand, the nice thing is that black hole physics is completely blind to the coupling with matter. This is the coupling with ordinary photons. So basically, we can still rule out a very large region of the parameter space. Of course, life is not that easy. There are a lot of things that I'm putting under the rug, as you probably noticed. So one is nonlinear effect that we more or less already discussed. And the other one, which I think is very important, is the fact that there is ordinary matter around spinning black holes in the universe. So this actually is what I was already mentioned. There is this series of very nice paper by Kodama and Yoshino. And let me just mention the problem of accretion disks. So we know that there is matter, of course, around black holes. And in particular, there are accretion disks very near the event horizon. So does this actually play a role in this instability? Well, if you consider dark matter candidate, it shouldn't, because dark matter candidate, by definition, interacts very weakly with ordinary matter. But for example, if you want to use these results to put constraints on possible massive photons, so try to constrain the mass of the photon with this kind of argument, then you face the problem that photons do interact with the plasma of the accretion. So they acquire an effective mass given by the plasma frequency, and this can change actually the picture. But this is actually very interesting because, so you have this accretion disk, which is more or less equatorial, but the instability is not equatorial because there are many different modes, which be, I mean, some of them are equatorial, some of them are instead off equatorial. So I mean, it's something interesting to understand whether matter interaction actually changed the picture or not substantially. And just to mention another thing, which is slightly related, so the case of spin 2 perturbation. So well, there are, so now in the last year there have been a lot of effort in trying to build, say, a theory of massive gravity. So eventually there have been a recent breakthrough in which they solved some problems related with Gauss of these theories. But anyway, when you try to linearize these theories around, say, a GR background, what you get are this kind of equation, regardless actually the nonlinear complexion of the theory you are considering. And there are two interesting things here. One is that if you look at this equation, say in the asymptotically flat case, so you neglect the cosmological constant, so of course these equations are propagating 5 degrees of freedom, which are the 5 healthy polarization of a massive graviton. But then you look at this equation and they look precisely the same as what you will get from if you start with a 5-dimensional black string and you perturb only a subsector, 4-dimensional subsector. Well, these are actually the equations that describe the Gregory-Laflamme instability of black string. This was recognized in this paper here by Babichev and Fabry. And so you will expect that Schwarzschild black holes in this theory are indeed unstable, precisely for the same reason why black string are. And indeed, these equations are the same if you identify the mass of the graviton with the Kaluza-Klein momentum in the extra dimension, essentially. So what we did with Richard Brito and Vitor here was to study this instability both in the asymptotically flat case and in the sitter case. And what you get is indeed that Schwarzschild black holes in these theories are unstable, at least for small mass, as you expect exactly for the Gregory-Laflamme instability. The instability is quite strong. The time scale grows like, the instability is linear in mu, essentially. And well, this is actually a very generic result that applies to any Schwarzschild black hole. It basically means that the Schwarzschild black hole, as we know in this theory, is not the good background. And you will expect the background to develop some kind of gravitational hair in this theory. So essentially, this should. This is for asymptotically flat and the sitter asymptotics.
Okay, so it's also unstable in the case of the sitter?
Yeah, so this blue line is for lambda equals zero. These other lines are for positive cosmological constants. But all these curves are cutted when you get the so-called Iguchi bound. So in those theories, when there is a very special value of the mass of the graviton, which is 2 lambda over 3, for which this mode disappears. So it becomes pure gauge, and you only have 4 polarizations. In that case, it seems that this theory is completely stable. So yeah, actually, something that I didn't mention is that this is a spherical symmetric instability. So that in that case, this mode disappears. In all other cases, for any lambda, there is instability. Okay. Well, of course, I mean, if you forget about this instability, you can do again what I was saying about superradiance, and this plot is very similar to what I showed you before. The difference, again, is in the scale. So here, there is a 10 to minus 3, more or less. So it means that you gain, again, 3 orders of magnitude. So this instability is yet stronger than in the spin 1 case. And again, this is consistent with what we expect. So the superradiance is stronger when you increase the spin of the perturbation.
But so let me just ask to try to understand what the rationale is. So why do you say if you forget about them? I mean, isn't the observation that it would be unstable?
Right. So, yeah. So I think that the rationale of doing this is the following: that we know that those backgrounds are unstable. So the Schwarzschild is unstable. You may expect that the stable background, say, will be a Schwarzschild-like black hole with some kind of hair around it. So there will be.
So why would you expect that?
Because that I showed you before is a spherical symmetric instability. So it's very similar, for example, to what you will get in the spontaneous scarization or in the scar case. So it's really like a spherical symmetric mode. So for example, if you are sitting here at this point here, these are purely imaginary modes. So there is no real part. It means that at this point here, there is a stationary perturbation, a static perturbation.
But like it's unstable.
it is unstable for Schwarzschild, but you may expect that this is a branch point. It's very similar to what you get, like, I don't know, higher dimensional black holes when you have this branch point and different solutions. This should signal actually a phase transition between the Schwarzschild solution and the another spherical symmetric solution.
Right, but that spherical symmetric solution, you're saying, well, it's going to be a black hole surrounded by some scarcity table.
Right.
Well, then I could also study perhaps as a perturbation charge, and that I know is unstable.
Right.
And so then, and we know what's going to happen.
No, I mean, it's unknown. This is for sure. So, I mean, people have not constructed the end state of this instability. It is likely, I would say that what you get is a spherical symmetric black hole with some kind of non-trivial profile of the scalar field. If that is the case, then it makes sense to study the super radiance because.
Can I follow up on that? I mean, don't we know that these solutions do have scalar hair? In the Bunstein screening mechanism is exactly some configuration of the scalar component of the graviton. So if I start with Schwarzschild with no configuration of that scalar, then
that is true, but isn't that related to the coupling with matter? Because the nice thing here is that there should be no Weinstein radius because these are vacuum solutions.
Well, you don't have any coupling between the scalar part and the energy moment tensor.
There is no energy moment tensor here. Yeah. So these are really the modes, the proper modes of the black hole. Actually, these are one of the beauties here because. I mean, you cannot play the same game with neutron stars, for example. I mean, you need a compact object, but for a neutron star, you will have this nonlinear coupling, this strong coupling. That I don't know. That is something that is probably interesting to look at. Yeah.
What was the question? Oh, I mean, if you have a point mass, even if you have a delta function source. If I start with no configuration of this extra mode, then I would kind of expect that that's unstable because it should just flow to the screen.
Mm-hmm. Right. So are you trying to argue that black holes would be kind of a limit, a point blank limit? Or?
No, I'm trying to argue that if you just started with the black hole with no quote scalar hair, then it would develop scalar hair, but you kind of expect that because you know that the right static solution is the one where there's this screen thing. But that's only in the it's a little bit subtle because I know that in these massive gravity theories, like the Schwarzschild solution, the horizon is singular in a lot of these theories.
There's
some really weird behavior of the scalar around the horizon.
Yeah.
Not in this solution.
They only get
singular, not because at least if you look at this from a biometric point of view, the horizons do coincide. Mm-hmm. So they are not singular.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
But I mean, the point is interesting.
Actually, I didn't mention, but these are the one of the few backgrounds that we know should be without those problems that you mentioned. Of course, an interesting problem that we are trying to understand is this is the, say, non-perturbed background. So this instability that you are talking about is because you have, say, two metrics, the standard one and the reference one, and they have two horizons in two different places. So then the problem is at nonlinear level, this perturbation or even stable perturbation are going to displace the two horizons. So is this actually going to show an instability because of the reason that you are saying or not? These are interesting questions.
I thought that people had shown that the usual result in GR, that the gravitational field outside of spherical symmetric configuration is only, it's only determined by the mass enclosed, is also true. And then I don't understand the difference between, like, if you look far away from the neutron star or black hole, the same mass, you see a different configuration? Is the static configuration? What is the, I'm forgetting the name of the
Birkhoff.
Birkhoff theorem, yes. I thought the Birkhoff theorem helped for these theories as well.
So that I'm not sure it could be, but what I was actually referring to is the fact that if you have a stress energy tensor, then this elasticity zero mode is strongly coupled with the stress energy tensor in some regime. And so there is a radius below, I mean, within which you don't trust the linearized theory anymore. And so what I was referring is that in this case, the team you knew is zero, so you are safe. And this is why you don't like, in this sense, neutron star. But perhaps you are right that the potential outside is the same. Right, exactly, yeah. And this is actually related to what you were saying.
Well, but just another comment. There's another motivation to look at the super area, which is outside, so for masses above that critical threshold, the space time is stable against spherically symmetric loads, but it may not be stable
against
non-spherically symmetric loads, right?
Right.
Yeah.
This is actually precisely super. Yeah.
Right.
And actually, there are no, in the steady case, this one, there are no other unstable modes for L different than zero. So these are really these are the only instability there are. Then, of course, if you turn on rotation, you get the R. Okay. Sure, no problem.
I want to get on part two, but that's like spin one is three orders of magnitude bigger than zero, and two is three orders of magnitude bigger than one. Is that right?
More or less, yeah. The hierarchy.
What's causing that?
What is causing that is not entirely clear. What we know is if you forget about the mass, gravitation, and you just do the experiment that was the Thog experiment that I was telling you before. So you throw a wave, and this is scattered by a Kerr black hole. Then the amplification factor for superions is much larger for gravitational waves than it is for electromagnetic wave than it is for scalar waves. So there is this hierarchy. So what you would expect is that if you are able with some mechanism, in this case is the mass, to enclose this amplification and make it, doing a laser, then you get a lot
of. Well, given first, yeah. What's causing first?
Why it is already in the? Well, that is that I don't know. I don't think that anybody does actually. Okay, that was part one. Now I'm going to change gear a bit and talk about, again, scalar fields, but they're, say, imprints in a different scenario. So in the extreme acceleration spiral. So the setup is that you consider a small compact object, say a neutron star, and it is orbiting around a supermassive black hole. So does the presence of a scalar field, which mediate this interaction, I mean, in addition to standard gravity, change the picture or not? Just to start very far away, so an interesting question is the following. We know that there are systems, gravitational systems, for which the binary, instead of shrinking the orbit, just outspirals. And the simplest example is the moon and the Earth. So we know that the moon actually nowadays is accelerating outwards. So the orbit is increasing in time. And the reason is because there is a dissipation. So there is friction between the Earth oceans and the crust. So there is a torque. By any angular momentum conservation, the orbit increases. And we can study it at Newtonian level very simply. This is the formula that you get at Newtonian level. And all your ignorance is parameterized by this parameter tau, which is the dissipation time scale. But then you think, well, okay, for a black hole, I do know the dissipation time scale is just there is just one dimensionful quantity, which is the black hole horizon. So I can plug this here in, and from the Newtonian formula, basically what I'm using is the membrane paradigm. And then you say, well, I replace the Earth by the black hole, and what I get is this formula here, which is precisely what you would expect from black hole perturbation theory. So in a very simple system, you get that the from a very simple Newtonian computation, you get that the flux at the horizon of a black hole change sign depending on the superadiant condition. So this is the superadiant condition. So when the particle is close enough, actually, well, when the orbital frequency is small enough, is smaller than the rotation at the black hole, you get a negative flux, which means that you are extracting energy from the black hole. And so the interesting question is, can actually a binary system formed by a particle and a black hole actually outspiral instead than in spiral because of this kind of effect? And we know that in GR this is not the case, because if you compare this flux at the horizon with the flux emitted in gravitational waves, when the outspiraling contribution is completely negligible, and this is actually a standard computation in even at Newtonian level, actually. Of course, when you have scalar fields, you can do better because gravity is a quadrupolar force, quadrupolar interaction. If you have a scalar field, you may have a dipolar interaction. So if you play the same game, well, you can extract more energy from the black hole. There is a very nice computation to do here. Well, and the final result is that still gravitational, well, emission of scalar waves dominates with respect to what you dissipate at your horizon. So the question is, can a black hole dissipate more than it does emit in gravitational waves? And the answer, curiously enough, is positive. I mean, is affirmative in two cases. One is when you have higher dimensions. So if you are in dimension higher than 5, and you take a circular orbit around a Myers-Perry black hole, what you get? What you get is, well, is that the flux at the horizon is larger than the flux at infinity, and the orbit outspiral, essentially. And the other case is when basically you have massive fields, as I told you before. So what happens here is that in the standard situation, the gravitational flux is usually much larger than the scalar flux here. So there are orders of magnitude of difference in these two cases. But then what you get is that since there is a mass of this scalar field, when the orbital frequency hits this mass, this is corresponding to a resonance of the central black hole, and then the scalar flux increases by order of magnitude. And so there are frequencies in the frequency space in which the scalar flux can be as large as the gravitational flux in absolute value. And so at this point, if you just compute the total flux, there is a point around here in which the total flux is zero, because the gravitational flux is completely compensated by the scalar flux. So the picture is that if you put a particle precisely at this frequency here, it will stay there, hovering, essentially. And the system will still emit gravitational waves, but not because the orbit is shrinking, but because the black hole is extracting angular momentum, essentially. So this is the picture. Of course, this is just a little story, but if you do computation more carefully, as we did with Nico Jones and Vitor here last year, what you get is that this signal is basically a monochromatic wave. So there is a particle staying there and emitting gravitational waves at constant frequency. And then this signal is also very different from what you expect in GR. And so, for example, using a projected bound obtained for future space-based detectors, because of course we are talking about supermassive black holes, what you get is that even a single detection of a gravitational wave signal will rule out an interesting region of the parameter space. Just because essentially what you get is that match and filter analysis cannot be matched with this kind of signal because it's too different.
Okay. So how can I imagine that? I mean, I have some orbiting body and then it passes through this instability band momentarily as it passes through this particular radius.
Mm-hmm. Right. So.
Or do I have something that inspirals in the earth? Do you imagine that things actually get caught in this particular orbit and then the things continuously emitting gravitational?
Right. Waves? That is precisely the picture. So. Of course, you start with the particle at infinity, or say when it enters the LISA band or whatever. Then what you get is that as the orbit is approaching this floating orbit, the flux is going, the total flux is going, is asymptotically going to zero. So actually, if you neglect any other effect, what happens is that the particle is asymptotically approaching that orbit. It's never going exactly there. So while it goes there, basically the orbital radius doesn't change in time. I mean, asymptotically, it doesn't change in time, and so the signal is approaching a monochromatic wave. So it's not, if you neglect any other effect, the orbit is never crosses this kind of flooding orbit, this kind of barrier for the flux, because the total flux is zero there. Okay. So yeah, so that was neglecting other effect. Let me just do the devil's advocate. And of course, there are many limitations in this picture here. Two of them are not, I would say they are not very crucial. One is that I'm considering circular orbit, but you may have eccentric orbit and non-equatorial orbit. Probably this is more technically involved, but the picture shouldn't change very much. Actually, there could be other kind of resonances that you may hit because of eccentricity. One important issue is that, as I showed you before, these resonances are extremely narrow. So One possible problem is that if instead of having a point particle as a zero approximation here, you have a finite size effect, then it might be that in the frequency space, the size of the object is even larger than the resonance. So it completely washes out the effect. And the same is true for the spin. So if the companion is spinning, well, this can actually change the picture. and well, and this may have an important effect.
In principle, the spin would not destroy the effect. The finite size could, right?
The finite size could. The spin, yeah, I would say that probably shifts something, but
changes the frequency.
Right. I would say, yeah, that it just changed the frequency. Well, I mean, you will expect, so in realistic scenario, you will expect something about 10 to minus 5. Actually, the limitation is what actually the detector will be sensitive, I mean, the region where the detector will be sensitive. And in the latest designs, will be around 10 to minus 5, the mass ratio. And then, I mean, if these finite size effects are important, well, then one should go, I mean, doing basically the next order in the mass ratio to understand whether.
Maybe is there a width over which, if you just estimate the width over which the resonance, the width and radius over which
right.
the outgoing flux is bigger than the incoming flux? Do you know how big that is?
Or yeah, no, we know that. Actually, there are also some analytical approximations. So the width is.
That's probably roughly.
Yeah. So that is the mass of the square field to the power of 9. So it's an extremely, and actually these are computation when mu is very small. So basically this is why the reason this is an extremely narrow resonance.
This is n times mu.
Right, yes. Right. So the dimensional number is that one. Yeah.
And,
right, but yeah, but on the other end, if it is too massive, you don't excite any mode for the same reason I told you before. So there is, yeah, there is an intermediate regime in which this may play a role.
And when the resonance is more sharply big, that's when it's narrow. So,
right. Yeah.
Did we ever compute the?
Actually, we think we have a kind of argument, as he's suggesting, so comparing the two things in the paper with Nico. I mean, naively, one would say that still it may play a role. Of course, there could be other more subtle effects that we are neglecting. But yeah, an order of magnitude estimate seems to confirm that it will still play a role. How much time do we have?
10 minutes.
Ah, okay. So. I still have a part 3. Well, this is very small. I just have 5 slides. So the magic word of the previous part of my talk was vacuum, as you may have understood. So basically, I'm always considering vacuum solutions. So black holes are interesting because they are vacuum solutions, but of course they are not. So there is matter around them, and so it is interesting to understand whether ordinary matter actually does play a role in this kind of scenarios. And this is interesting for one reason. So, well, now let me focus on scalar fields. And the simplest way we can include a scalar field with matter is considering a scalar tensor theory, which looks like something like that. So this is in the so-called Einstein frame. There is a minimally coupled scalar field. And the only way it enters in an interesting way is coupling, being coupled non-minimal with matter. So there is this theorem by Stephen Hawking in the 70s and generalized last year by Sotiriou and Farroni. And in the most general version, it states that in electro vacuum, any asymptotically flat and stationary solution in the scalar tensor theory belongs to the Kerr-Newman family. So if you forget charge, it means that in vacuum, what you get are just Kerr black holes as a final state of a gravitational collapse. But of course, the important thing is that you must be in vacuum. If you are not in vacuum, well, it's very simple to see from the scalar equation that if you are not in vacuum, you have this term here. And basically, any time this generic coupling function A prime is non-zero, well, you don't get any constant scalar field configuration. So you may expect that you have a black hole and some accretion disk. Then there must be a sort of scalar hair which interpolates between the black hole and the scalar field, between the black hole and the accretion disk. So why this effect is interesting? Well, because it seems that actually experiments are pointing out to the fact that this A prime should be very close to zero. So we may have, even inside matter, solutions which are very pretty much like GR solutions. And we know this effect in neutron stars. So actually, these are the bounds on this parameter A prime. Essentially, experiments are excluding all this region of the parameter space, but this region here. And you may, of course, so this alpha naught is what I call A prime somehow. Basically, when alpha naught is zero, you are somewhere here, which is completely within the experiment. And the interesting point is that this theory is allowed for GR solutions, but strangely enough, the GR solutions are not always entropically favored, in the sense that if you have enough matter around the solution, or I mean, which forms the solution, like for a neutron star case, well, the neutron star spontaneously scalarized, and this process was called spontaneous scalarization in the 90s by Damour and collaborators. And when Barahousse recently, last year, Barahousse, Palanzuela, Pons, and Luis here studied this phenomenon for a neutron star binary. So what happens is that even in a region of the parameter space which is completely allowed by current observation, you get order one deviation from generativity. For example, in this case, in the in how the binary changed in time, the separation of the binary, and also in the emission of gravitational waves, which are very different from GR. So the point is, does something similar happen for black holes? And indeed, well, the system is very similar and also much easier to study because we are in vacuum basically here. And what you get is that if you just linearize the scalar equation around, say, a Schwarzschild black hole, what you get is an effective mass term given by this coupling here. These are just numbers related to this unknown function A that I mentioned before. And they are, of course, proportional to the matter term. So what you get is that if this effective mass term squared is negative, this signal instability, again, is a sort of tachyonic instability. And there is also a very simple way to estimate when the instability is effective. And of course, there is a threshold, say, amount of matter above which the instability basically takes over, and what happens is that the Schwarzschild black hole spontaneously generates a sort of scalar air which interpolates between the vacuum and this kind of configurations. So, and we played with some toy model. This is a paper that is still not even in the archive. We are still working on it, and it turns out that if you have some matter which somehow models the presence of matter around, say, the ISCO around a black hole, well, what happens is that this phenomenon is very generic. So the instability occurs for very generic matter profiles. And I think the most interesting, actually, phenomenon is another one, that when this effective mass squared, instead of being negative, so instead of producing a tachyonic instability, is positive, and this is completely allowed because this is a free parameter which is almost unconstrained by experiment, then what you get is, again, a scalar field with a mass term. This time, the mass term is physical because it's positive. And then you are exactly in the same situation that I told you before. So there is a scalar field with a mass term, and this is superoriented unstable. And indeed, what you get is that there is a superoriented instability. And another phenomenon is that if you consider, again, the scattering of waves of these rotating black holes when there is matter, instead of having the usual superoriented amplification, which is typically very, very small, is about 0.4% for a scalar field here, well, you may have, again, resonance effect related to the fact that there is matter here. So there are, in some cases, there are amplification of four orders of magnitude or more just because there is matter. And here we are in a region of parameter space which is completely, allowed by experiment. There are no weak field bounds on it. So I think that this was my last slide. I hope I convince you that black holes are interesting laboratories to study particle physics and modified gravity. There are some challenges still to study this phenomenon in black hole perturbation theory and also in numerical simulation. But in the recent year, there has been a lot of progress. And now we are in a position to say something interesting, both for, say, parameter space of dark matter candidates, putting bounds on mass of bosonic fields, and also to have some insights of alternative theories of gravity. So these are actually the smoking guns and almost model independent parameter that I'm I've been discussing today. The interesting thing is that if you don't believe, for example, on extension of GR, you may just really use GR and black holes observations to try to put constraints on particle physics. And most of the things that I told you today are related to the fact that somehow, in a way or in the other, black holes may develop scalar errors or different kind of errors in the solutions. If you are skeptical about that, well, you should remember that sometimes nature prefers airy solutions than airless solutions. So this is an example of famous and less famous people in their airless version. So the take-home message is: do not estimate errors. Thank you. I don't know a lot of. Some of them are teenagers, idols, something like that. These four, I think, are teenagers, idols. Actually, I know only three of them. Yeah.
So, have you guys? I asked before, but let me just here. So, would you try what? So, what would you do next? So, you're. To include the list of some of the back reactions on the last part, you're saying, well, that you have somehow accommodated things with respect to, say, having an ISCO and the matter being there. Mm-hmm. And now if you're attracting any momentum, then the ISCO is going to move, and the matter is going to have to do something. Mm-hmm. You could somehow incorporate some effective way the back reactions, at least on the zeroth order part.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure which way the answer is going to change.
So that is surely relevant. I would say that even before doing that, I would like to understand better. So we were really using toy models for this matter interaction, matter around the black hole. So first we were really using a Schwarzschild black hole with some matter around it. And of course, you know that the solution is not a Schwarzschild black hole and matter, because this is not even a solution in GR. So yeah, something that I think that we should first understand is, if, for example, this instability is present when the matter profile is, say, realistic enough. Those things that I was showing, for example, we were trying this with these matter profiles here, among others, actually. But this is just a radial profile, so it's spherical symmetric. And actually, you would expect that there is some angular dependence also. And that could change the picture a lot, because basically it reflects the wave in different... People have tried not to have, like, a spherical symmetric mirror, but having a distorted mirror, and that changed the things a lot, because you want something to be resonant and it's not. So that would be the first thing I would say. Yeah. Yes, please.
Well, this is probably a question to the first part of the talk. So has there been work on how the interaction these particles with supermassive black holes can have an influence in the cosmological context? Say if you start with the black hole mass function and study how it evolves as a function of redshift, has this been done? Because you could probably derive rather complementary constraints on the parameters.
Yeah. That precisely I don't know. There has been a lot of work for to trying to constrain this particle at cosmological level. I'm not sure whether people have studied the dynamics of supermassive black hole and how it changed with the mass of the galaxy. That I don't know. But yeah, it's something that should be interesting to think about.
Okay, there are no other questions. Let's thank Paul again.